My research has long been directed towards the proteins that are used to build the insect, namely its cuticular proteins. And in terms of competition, it's been a wonderful field to study because there are very few people who work in this area, unlike crowded fields some of the rest of you are in. Now, there's an obvious justification for the title of my talk. Since cuticle is on the outside of the insect, it's obviously the cuticle that's interacting with the real world. And since the cuticle is made up of cuticular proteins, it's obviously the cuticular proteins that are interacting with the real world. But why should vector biologists care about cuticular proteins? That's the purpose of this talk. Anopheles obviously cares. This is something one of my postdocs said when he gave a seminar recently. He said, you all know Judy cares about cuticular proteins, but Anopheles cares too. 2% of the genes of Anopheles, of the predicted number of genes of Anopheles, are used for coding for cuticular proteins. And of the genes who've actually been given names, 18% of those genes are cuticular proteins. So they're obviously very important. And vector biologists are beginning to care about cuticular proteins. There are chromosomal regions which are densely populated with cuticular proteins, and these regions have been implicated in plasmodium vector competence and intolerance to irididine. I'll show you some data in a minute. And specific cuticular proteins have also been implicated in tolerance to arididine, to MS population differences, and insecticide tolerance. On chromosome 2, on the left arm of chromosome 2, there is a large inversion. And that inversion has been correlated with both vector competence and desiccation resistance. Nora Bozensky has carefully mapped the precise location of this inversion. And in addition to that, by using DNA hybridization to microarrays, she's been able to find the precise regions which are different between the A and the A-plus forms. And there are two regions which predominate, cluster 1 and cluster 2. When you have an inversion, the regions that fall out in the inversion are very apt to have crossing over with the homologous chromosome. But the regions which are at the ends of the inversion are apt to stay different. What Nora was particularly excited about was this cluster 2, which was a little way in from the end of the inversion. So this is where the inversion ends, and this cluster 2 are genes that she thinks are going to be the ones which are most important in aridity resistance. And the reason she has gotten in touch with me and has been giving me tutorials on the 2LA inversion is because that cluster has a large number of cuticular protein genes in just one family, the CPR family. There are a total of 178 genes, 39 of them code for cuticular proteins. And she has begun to look for sequence differences between particular genes on the A and the A plus form. And she's only looked at two cuticular proteins so far. And one of them, CPR63, has a different sequence in the two forms. Insecticide resistance has been analyzed in a Nigerian population of Anopheles stephensi by Ranson and people she's associated with. And they've done some mapping too. And what they did was expression mapping. And there is one gene in Anopheles stephensi, which we had previously identified in Anopheles gambia named CPLC8. And by either microarray hybridization or by real-time PCR, there is a significant difference, and the most impressive difference, in expression levels between the resistant and the sensitive forms. So if you're a vector biologist and you want to know where Anopheles gambiae can live and you want to know what it's resistant to, you probably should start getting interested in cuticular proteins. Okay? So, cuticular proteins are relevant not only to the insect, but they should be relevant to vector biologists. And so now you should want to hear, I hope, lessons about cuticular proteins. So, what's the cuticle? Unlike most textbooks, it's a composite of cuticular chitin and proteins. Chitin is just dull polyN-acetylglucosamine, unless someone's here from Kansas where they think something else may be going on. It's okay. Cuticular proteins are diverse in size, they're diverse in amino acid composition, and I'm going to show you that they're distinct families of cuticular proteins, and I've already shown you that Anopheles gambi has lots of them. Okay, so this is what I'm going to tell you about. It's all you about annotation and verification of the cuticular proteins of gambi, about their expression, some proteomics data, and some phylogenetics data. And Augustine Dunn was my technician and really got the project started with me and really was got us lots of the programs which we've used for the analysis and got us started on them. And as a result of our preliminary work, NIH was rather generous in funding this project. And so I have a new technician now. There was a very energetic undergraduate who was involved. There were two short-term postdocs who I knew were going to be short-term when I hired them, who got the proteomics project started. And the three major players are Toru Tagawa, who has just arrived with the jump drive, Scott Kornman, and Ningjia He. And they've really done the bulk of the work, and the slides which have their contributions are all going to be labeled properly. And we had a faculty collaborator, Ron Orlando, who's in our Complex Carbohydrate Research Center and is UGA's expert on mass spec. So there are various families of Anopheles gambi cuticular proteins. The CPR family has the Reavers and Rutherford consensus, which is about 65 amino acids, and I'll tell you more about that in a minute. The CPF family has a conserved region of about 42 amino acids and conserved carboxy terminus. This was originally described by Sven Anderson when he described it, and Locus and Tenebrio, he thought there was a consensus of about 52 amino acids. Toru's work has shown that it's only about 40. We had originally named it CPF for 50. It's now CPF for 40, but you know, the F still works, so we were very fortunate. I got worried as Toru was narrowing it down that we might get below 40, but he didn't. He then found that there was a CPFL family that does not have the 42 amino acid consensus, but the carboxy terminus is very much like the CPFs. We have a CPR plus C family, which has something that looks very much like the R&R consensus, but has a couple of cysteines. Cysteines are rarely found in cuticular proteins. And this is what enables us to tell the difference between cuticular proteins and other chitin-binding proteins, such as the paratrophic membrane proteins, because they are highly dependent on having cysteines to get them folded properly. And the other class of structural proteins in insects, the corian proteins, are also very rich in cysteine. So we have a really distinct class of proteins with most of our cuticular proteins. The CPR plus C have a couple of conserved cysteines. We have the CPTCs, which have two conserved cysteines. And then there's a family of low complexity proteins, which we now know actually consists of multiple proteins. My favorite ones are the Tweedles. The Drosophila people have recently had a paper where they had a mutant in Drosophila which gave rise to a very robust larva who looked to them very much like Tweedledee, and so they're called the Tweedles. And we have some that are proline rich, we have some that have a WNY repeat, we have some that go GHP in a little space and then another GHP, and then we have some which are so low complexity we can't find anything in them. So the annotation I'm going to tell you about has been confirmed by checking for TATA boxes, for poly-A addition sites, for initiator elements, for downstream promoter elements. Each gene that we've annotated and called a cuticular protein has to have a signal peptide, because you don't get into the cuticle unless you have a signal peptide. And problematic genes were confirmed with either race or cDNAs, but we did not do that for all of the genes. And about three-fourths of the genes, of the CPR genes, were modified from the initial annotation on Ensemble. It was a good way to get started, but there was a lot of manual annotation that had to go on. But are all these proteins really cuticular proteins, or are they just figments of annotation? Proteins and peptides have been isolated now from Cas cuticles, from larval head capsules and pupal cuticle. When I first started working with cuticular proteins, and Diana worked with me, we used to take 15 or 20 gram larvae, freeze them, take off the cuticle, spend a lot of time with little pieces of filter paper scraping off the epidermis, scraping off the attached muscles, and then extracting cuticular proteins for analysis. You do not do that with anopheles. And so we let anopheles clean its own cuticles. When it molts, it very carefully cleans off all of the cells, all of the fat bodies, and leaves behind what we thought would be very clean cuticles. So those are the preparations we use for the proteomics analysis. And we've also extended that a little bit. There's a sieving procedure which gives you fairly enriched preparations of cuticle proteins. It turns out that in actuality, HIB capsules and cast pupil cuticles have some muscle attached, because muscle inserts into the cuticle, and that does not come off even after molding. They leave some behind. And there are lots of molting fluid proteins which stick around even though we do extensive washing, and I think they're just trapped in legs and things. But after all that's been done, and proteins have been isolated from that, you have some stuff for which nothing was soluble. We treated that with trypsin. We got lots of peptides, and almost all of those peptides belong to cuticular proteins. And if anyone else wants to go doing proteomics, I would recommend, you know, well-washed cast skins, and you're going to get nice preparations. Now, there's a complication. Many of the cuticular proteins are very similar to one another. My first foray into anopheles cuticular proteins was a project that Frank Collins and I initiated, and Ellen Dodson did the work when she was a postdoc with us between UGA and CBC. And she only isolated three genes for cuticular proteins, and they were very similar to each other. They differed primarily in a number of repeats in them, and then in their 5' and 3' UTRs. So when you start doing proteomics, you discover that there are lots of peptides which are not unique for a particular protein. So for these three, we were capable of finding unique peptides, which are what are highlighted in gray, for CPR1 and CPR3, but all the things where they're just colored letters are cuticular proteins that are shared not only among these, but there are three more proteins which are in this one family of closely related genes. So we have then unique peptides and shared peptides. And this is a summary. After Ribeiro, can I call it a cuticlone? This is the first time I've dared to use the term. The CPR family, the one with the Reavers and Ritter-Free consensus, there are 156 genes in the pest strain of Anopheles gambit. That's the sequence strain. We have managed to confirm with unique peptides 48%, with shared peptides 45%, 93% of them are shared, and this brings up another problem. All our experimental work has been done with the G3 strain of Anopheles. Why didn't we use the pest strain? Who knows? It doesn't exist. Precisely. Okay. That's another problem. For the CPFs, we have peptides, unique peptides for all of them. For the CPFLs, we have unique peptides for most of them. We shared peptides for most of them. CPTCs, unique peptides. CPR plus Cs, unique peptides. And all these peptides now are coming out of cuticle preparations. So these are not putative cuticular proteins. These are authentic cuticular proteins for the vast majority. And for the complexes of the CPLCs, lots of them are authentic. And indeed, the original plan was to do the proteomics project near the end, after we had done the annotation. And it turned out, to a large extent, the proteomics project drove the annotation, because we were able to match peptides to predicted proteins, or partially predicted proteins, and then go in and analyze those genes. So we knew we had cuticular proteins, and we went backwards from that. So we now have a total of at least 233 cuticular proteins. There's another group of CPLCs that are still being worked up, and there may be some more. And at least 92% in G3 agree with either shared or unique peptides. So we have a lot of authentic cuticular proteins. When I gave you that number of, you know, almost 2% of the genes, it was real. Okay. The CPR family, which is the largest, that was the one with 156, has two groups that Anderson named, RR1 and RR2. I'll tell you about them now. When we first started working on Cecropia, this large silk moth's cuticular proteins, because of work Diana had done, I suggested that we should get two genes out, one for a protein called 12, one called 66. 12 came from the soft cuticles of the larva, and it was also found in the intersegmental membranes of pupa, and it turned out to be an RR1 protein when Lynetta Binger did her thesis and got the complete sequence and the gene. And then I had another student, David Lampe, who got HCCP66, and that turned out we had gotten it originally from pupal cuticle. It's also in larval tubercles, it's in larval grid capsules, so that was a hard cuticle protein. And I marvel now that I had two students get doctoral theses, you know, one gene each. Those days are now long gone. One of the next things we did was try to find out about this RNR consensus, which is found in the majority of cuticle proteins from all species. And the RNR consensus, which John Reavers had first identified, he spent a sabbatical in my lab and was able to show that proteins with the RNR consensus bind to chitin. This is the input protein, lots of washes, and then you elute it with 8-mole urea off a chitin binding column. He was also able to take just the consensus region, 65 amino acids, fuse it onto glutathione S transferase, and show the same thing, that it bound to chitin. And so the reason the RNR consensus is so conserved and so widely used is because it's what confers chitin binding onto these proteins. Its ability to do this was subsequently confirmed by Tagawa in Japan before he joined my group. And he subsequently has looked at the CPF proteins with the same conditions. CPF proteins are a mess to work with. They aggregate. But once we solve the aggregation problem, we've got nice solutions of them. The CPF proteins, neither CPF1 or CPF3, bind to chitin, although another one of the RNR proteins does under the same conditions. Now, more about the genes. The 156 CPR genes are present as singletons, that means scattered around the chromosome, and in tandem arrays. We've defined as tandem arrays genes that are no more than 20 kilobases from another CPR gene. And within tandem arrays, we find sequence clusters of genes that are almost identical in sequence. So within this tandem array, there are two distinct sequence clusters. And genes and sequence clusters are not always tightly linked. This is an example where we have one sequence cluster outlined in red. Here's another sequence cluster that comes in between. And CPR149 by sequence belongs to that sequence cluster. They're close by, but they need not be contiguous. And you're going to find out why sequence clusters are important. When Scott Corman did the first phylogeny of the Anopheles-Gambi CPR proteins, he found that there were really big differences between the RR1 and the RR2 proteins. The RR1s are all long branch proteins, whereas we get these sequence clusters that I showed you a second ago in the RR2 proteins. So, what is special about these sequence clusters of such similar genes? We've only found sequence clusters with RR2 genes. They're not found in Drosophila, and they have three distinct features. They have a much more compact gene architecture. They generally have no or only one intron, and when they have introns, they're shorter than in the non-clustered or the RR1 proteins. RR2 proteins and sequence clusters are also generally shorter than the RR2 single copy genes or the RR1 genes. So these are the properties of the proteins themselves. And although this is difficult, it's not as difficult to see here as it is on a screen. That's nice. This is the principal components analysis of the entire protein. And these big symbols are all genes from sequence clusters. The sequence clusters are outliers in the principal components analysis. And that's saying that this group is varying primarily in their content of alanine. The groups up here vary a lot and have more histidines, and the ones down here have more glycines, whereas the non-sequence cluster ones tend to scatter or tend to be less different and in the middle of this principal components analysis. There are no sequence clusters in Drosophila. Drosophila only has 102 CPR genes. None of them are arranged in sequence clusters. But what is interesting, when you look at Gambi, Aedes aegypti, and Melanogaster, for the single copy genes, you find many orthologs. So here's a case where we have an orthologous triplet, another one here, another one here, another one here. One of my favorite genes is CPR144. CPR144 has three copies of the consensus. All of the other CPR genes have, did I say have three copies of the consensus? All the others have only one copy of the consensus. And CPR144 is found not only in these three dipterans, but it's also found in Tribolium. So it's one of the things that are telling us that particular cuticular protein genes are doing something very special, especially over that period of time if you're maintaining such distinct orthologs. Ooh, is that? Okay, okay. We have sequence clusters. Sequence clusters have different numbers of genes in the different species. And in the last 5 minutes, I want to tell you about gene expression studies because they provide some very interesting clues as to what's going on. This is work that Toru Tagawa did. He collected animals at 12 hours intervals after each molt. We were very careful to make sure the primers were gene specific, and there's no normalizing genes, so we're going to show you raw data corresponding to the actual levels of RNA that were converted into cDNAs, which were measured with real-time PCR. Okay, and the data are going to be organized like this. This is just one of the clusters that he found. We used the same program, which Tony and others have used to look at their microarray data, and there are 21 co-expression clusters that come out of our data. These are the different developmental stages with different colors, and you can see that this particular gene is highly expressed late in L4, which means that it's actually in the ferrate pupil stage. Here are the 21 co-expression clusters, and what you can see from these that there are sharp peaks of expression. Most peaks are associated with molts, which means they come near the end of an instar, and some transcripts are present only before diocese ferrate stages, and others before and after, and some just after. There's other kinds of data which we can get. We can ask whether a co-expression cluster has both RR1 and RR2 genes, and the answer is yes. We can ask about sequence clusters. I'll show you that in a minute. We can ask about tandem arrays, and we can look at the raw expression levels. And all of that is summarized on this slide. And the bottom line is, if you look at these gray things, which are which all the dark grays are the same tandem array, genes and tandem arrays are not coordinately expressed. On the other hand, genes and sequence clusters are coordinately expressed. And the other thing which I'll just mention is most of the sequence cluster genes are very highly expressed. So here are specific data for sequence clusters, and you can see that they really have extremely similar patterns of expression. The other thing that's been done is we've looked at CPF proteins, and CPF proteins are expressed a little bit earlier than even the earliest of the CPRs, and we think that they're probably in the epicuticle, and although it's a little controversial, it's thought that the epicuticle does not have chitin, which fits in very well with our inability to demonstrate chitin binding. So we worried about what is responsible for the coordinate regulation of genes in sequence clusters. Toru used the program TESS. All of the genes, all 152 which are in that analysis, had putative binding sites for E74, which is one of the early genes in the dicesteroid cascade. Almost all of the other genes in the dicesteroid cascade were present. And then when you start looking, you can find almost every known transcription factor in one or dozens of these genes, and it's much too early to make any sense out of it. So, why are there so many cuticular protein genes? We think it's partly to facilitate massive cuticular protein synthesis. Since the individual genes and sequence clusters are fairly highly expressed, in order to make a lot of cuticle, which that mosquitoes have to do in a short period of time since their development is so rapid, we think that they had to have more genes in order to make more cuticle. They couldn't ramp up expression anymore. We think certainly that they provide diverse structures for diverse functions. That's what the principal components analysis told us, that different genes are quite different, or different groups of genes are quite different from one another. And certainly with the real-time data, We're getting a lot of temporal control, and we're now beginning to do in situ hybridization to learn something about spatial control. So, in conclusion, cuticular proteins are obviously important. They've been implicated in aridity tolerance, insecticide resistance, vector competence, other real-world problems. They're present a fruitful field for many more years of study by somebody. And I thank you for your attention, and I hope your future interest in these proteins.
Thank you very much, Judy. Matthew?
You were looking at CAP scan of pupae, right?
Well, we did larval head capsules and pupae.
But how does that relate to an adult human?
Well, that's why we had to do these sieved extracts of whole animals. And we've also ground up whole adults and then just run the data against the cuticle protein database. We have based on the expression analysis, we have a small number of proteins that appear to be adult specific. Most of them we've also found in the larval head capsules by proteomics analysis.
Yes, is it possible to test for redundancy of function by silencing samples?
So Michael Kanosh just left. The Kansas group in Tribolium is beginning to do RNAi on them. And I think because they're so similar, we could design RNAi which would knock out groups or individuals, but we aren't there yet. Do you want to give me my next grant?
Judy, tell me a little bit more about that aridity of tolerance. Are you suggesting that specific ones have that, specific abilities in aridity tolerance, or you're saying just because of particular proteins? I always think of the wax layers being involved. That aridity tolerance.
Okay.
So proteins.
Okay, so what I can tell you is that in Daphnia, the Daphnia people in Indiana, and they've given this at a meeting, so I guess it's all right to talk about it. It hasn't been published yet. They've been subjecting Daphnia to different salinities and to different heavy metals and saying what genes are showing differential gene expression, and they're the cuticular protein genes. Now, I haven't seen the data. I think it may be more heavy metals than salinity. But it looks like possibly how thick your cuticle is or what proteins you put in it. And Nora Bozensky is being very cautious about implicating cuticular protein genes, but we're both overwhelmed by the numbers which are in that cluster two of hers.
Yeah, that's sort of follow-up question. I wonder if there's any suggestion that by maybe exposing to certain stresses, desiccation or something, you might favor certain ones. Other questions from Judy? Okay, well, thank you very much.